for House Bill 5020, Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Paul, did you want to say anything? We're ready to go. First, I want to announce that we're back online for Thursday public hearings, so tell anyone that you might hear or see or ask you that we are going to have our public hearing for Fish and Wildlife Thursday afternoon at 1 o'clock. And I'd like to call Lisa Pearson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and I'll be presenting the governor's budget using this document. The predominant piece of this will be the governor's balanced budget as of December, but the final page we'll be talking about what was produced last week. If you turn to page 2, this table is the standard table with the historical expenditures, comparing the governor's budget as of December with the 2001-03 biennium budget through the fifth special session. The governor's balanced budget was a 0.3% increase in total funds, with about a 5% decrease in general fund, about a 3% decrease in lottery fund, and that primarily came from a phase out of 1999-2001 biennium fish screen money. That was used up, so that's no longer available. There was about a 5% increase in other funds from the proposed fee increase as it stood in December. There's about a 0.3% decrease in federal funds, 100% decrease in other funds non-limited, which was used for debt service on the Portland headquarters building, but because the agency is moving to Salem, that will be taken care of and debt will no longer need to be paid on that. And actually, there is a proposal to use a similar amount of money to pay the rent on the new building. But that would not be non-limited. And then there was about a 0.5% increase in full-time equivalents. Turning to page 3, there's a pie chart that shows the major funds that support this agency's budget. It's pretty much equally divided between other funds and federal funds, with other funds having a slight advantage. General fund follows, and then lottery fund is the smallest category of funding for this agency. And at that time, or for the governor's balanced budget, the general fund was about $15.9 million of the total, and the lottery funds were about $9.3 million. Turning to page 4. This slide gives a very high summary of what was in the governor's balanced budget. Again, it was a 0.3% increase in total funds from the fifth special session, and it did include major changes from the first through fifth special sessions, including reduced landowner assistance, hatchery emergency maintenance was reduced, the Klamath Basin restoration work and Oregon plan assistance was reduced. There was an Oregon plan fund shift in the second special session, which we'll come back to in a moment. And then there were hatchery fund shifts for the Salmon River, Cedar Creek, Bass River, and Elk River fish hatcheries. Major programs and services included in the governor's budget continues wildlife habitat game and diversity programs and fish hatcheries, screens, and surveys. Turning to page 5, this pie chart shows the breakout by program of the funding in the governor's budget as of December. The highest or largest program is the natural production program at 23%, followed by fish propagation. Then we get into administration, followed by the game program and interjurisdictional fisheries. And following that would be, state police, habitat division, and marine resources. Turning to page 6, the largest category of expenditures, as shown by this pie chart, is personal services at 58%. That's followed by services and supplies at 32%. And capital outlay and special payments are at the same percentage or proportion of the budget. The personal services is about $126 million. Total funds in the governor's budget as of December is about 69.6 or 70 per million for total funds in services and supplies. Capital outlay was about $12 million, and special pay was about $12 million. Turning to page 7, this slide shows how the governor's budget was created or developed. Started with the legislatively adopted budget of $214 million. It also included legislatively approved actions through April 2002, including a number of emergency board actions. There was a naturescaping grant for about $10,000. There was a wetland restoration grant for Ladd Marsh that was about $50,000. There was a Western Oregon Stream Restoration Program that was about $960,000. There was a position for the Chippewa Basin Technical Assistance that was about $70,000, and that was a limited duration position. There was about $575,000 of other funds for the Oregon Coastal Monitoring Program. And then there was about $107,000 of other funds and one limited duration position for the Department of Transportation Technical Assistance. In Special Session 2, there were reductions to green forage in the deer program, to fish stocking, to the Willamette and Cedar Creek hatcheries, and to screens maintenance, among other reductions as well. And as I mentioned earlier, there was also a fund shift for the Oregon plan in the second special session, which we will see in a moment, is reversed.
Lisa, could I ask you to go back to page 5 and give us the dollar amounts in each of those categories? Are you able to do that?
For each of the programs?
Mm-hmm.
I can do that. The total funds for each of the program units are as follows in the governor's budget. $22.1 million for game, $16.3 million for habitat, $3 million for wildlife, $45.9 million for propagation, $50.1 million for production, natural production, $10.1 million for marine, $16.5 million for interjurisdictional fisheries, $6.3 million for Habitat Division, $11.9 million for Oregon State Police, $2.9 million for administration, and $7.8 million for capital.
Excuse me, I think I must have heard you wrong. On administration, how much was that?
$2.9,
but that's 13%?
Oh, I probably have a typo. Can you hold on just a moment? $29. Decimal point problem.
That looks better.
Yeah. That'd be nice if it was 2.9, but they couldn't operate there.
Yeah. Boy, we just made some money.
They won't be able to operate
again. Problem solved. We're out of here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Base budget adjustments, as with all other natural resource agencies and frankly all other state agencies, the governor's balanced budget did include the standard merit increases that have been discussed and will be pulled out, but as of December they had not been removed yet. Moving on to essential packages, there was a package standard for non-position information control system things such as mass transit. The O2O phase out package includes phase outs of all of the emergency, well, most of the emergency board actions that were taken that I went through just previously, including the grants, the limited duration positions. There was a phase out of carryover expenditure limitation for fish screens from the 1999-2001 biennium. There was a phase out of Diamond Lake fish stocking, which was a one-time expenditure. And then there was the repayment of the loan from the deferred maintenance subaccount, which actually now is not funded with general fund as it had originally been in intended by the 2001 legislature, but in what we're commonly referring to as Special Session 6, that was moved to a different source of funding, and that general fund came out. So this piece of the governor's balanced budget is really no longer relevant. Moving on to inflation, as with other natural resource agencies, this agency received inflation, which was standard. Unlike the big three general fund policy areas, education, human services, and public safety, natural resources did not in December take a reduction to inflation, but it is anticipated that it will, in fact, lose its inflation as well, and to maintain some consistency with those large three policy areas. Turning to page 9, we go to the fund shifts, and this 050 package reverses the fund shifts that were taken in Special Session 2, and that was for the Oregon plan and then also for stock assessments. So those revert back to the regular fund type, and that would be to restore general fund for the stock assessment and also for the Oregon plan. In the 070 revenue shortfalls package, there are a number of reductions, which are summarized on the slide, that reflect the need to balance the budget to revenues. And these reductions actually are addressed by policy packages, which we'll get to in a moment, that rely upon a fee increase in a piece of legislation that has been proposed. So if the legislation and the fee increase did not pass, the wildlife programs would be affected in wildlife damage, green forage, deer enhancement, restoration programs, big game surveys. Fish programs would be affected through fish inventory, monitoring in the high desert, the northeast and northwest regions, LaGrande, Clackamas, and Roseburg service, lower Columbia and coastal estuary sturgeon population estimates, Rock Creek and North Nehalem hatcheries. Enforcement, we would lose state police officer or fish and wildlife officer positions, and there would be a loss to accounting and information services as well in administration. Turning to page 10, policy packages that are the results of special session actions include the 081 package, which was for the third special session. That includes the standard salary range 38 and above adjustment to salaries. Then there were reductions specific to the agency, and those include the trout hatchery manager, the trout research coordinator, the administrative assistant too. And there was a rebalance which reduced other funds but did not change the general fund or the federal funds or the lottery funds. And that included a reduction of 22 positions. This was to clean up the position count and the FTE count primarily in relation to concerns expressed by the 2001 legislature and a budget note. In the 082 package, Special Session 5, Section 1, there was a fund shift of hatchery funding for four hatcheries. I may not be right about that, but moving general fund to other fund, and that was assumed to continue into the 2003-05 biennium. Moving to page 11, policy packages continued regarding the special sessions. With the failure of Measure 28, there were reductions taken to wildlife habitat, landowner assistance, wildlife game, field operations, hatchery maintenance, groundfish studies, fish administration, Klamath Basin restoration work, and Oregon plan support to other entities, deferred maintenance, and capital improvement. Virtually, obviously, everything was touched because the reductions were across appropriations as required by this fifth special session. Turning to page 12, this slide very briefly summarizes the policy packages for the agency, and they're grouped by what they do. The first set of policy packages have to do with the 070 policy package that we saw earlier, and this would allow the programs to be restored that were cut in the 070 package, but it depends on the fee increase, And so if that fee increase were not to be adopted, the reductions in the 070 package would stand. Then in the next set of packages, these would continue the 2001-03 services, and these restore packages that or elements that were reduced or phased out in the 020 package, primarily having to do with limited duration positions. The work is ongoing, but the positions automatically go away at the end of the current biennium. So if the work is to continue, the agency would need to have those positions restored. And again, fees would cover those. Package 222, fish screens, is a package that provides funding for the fish screen program. And it is funded with lottery funds. And package 260 is the reclassification of a position. And package 440 is a increase to the, well, not increase, but there's some additional resources provided to budgeting and human resources because the administration of the agency has not been adequate, frankly, to the task at hand in terms of the staff and resources available to it. And then package 450 is that package I mentioned about the change in budgeting for the headquarters building. Since they no longer own the building or will no longer own the building, they no longer need to pay debt service on it, and that would then be used for rent instead on the Salem property. Fee and revenue changes. There's House Bill 2258, which extends the sunset of surcharge for access and habitat programs. House Bill 2259 extends the surcharge for fish restoration and enhancement programs. Package 2260 is a hunting and angling fee increase. And there were no new programs or governor's investments. And now we get down to the most recent information, which is on page 13. And these are the governor's adjustments that were put out last week. And the first group are fund shifts. And these are summarized by the kind of fund shifting that goes on. There are fund shifts of Measure 66 Operations Lottery Fund to the Federal Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund. This would affect the Oregon Plan monitoring support, and it would reduce lottery fund about $3.9 million and increase federal fund about $3.9 million. It wouldn't have a position effect because it's simply changing the color of money rather than taking a reduction to a program. The next group, shift general fund to the Federal Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds. This affects fish screens, program support, habitat biologists, and quantifying fish flows. And that would reduce $773,750 of general fund and use the same amount of federal fund. Again, there would be no position or FTE change because it's simply changing the color of money, not making a reduction to the program. The next group shifts general fund to Measure 66 Operations Lottery Fund. That would affect the spawning surveys and habitat protection. That's a reduction of $52,067 general fund and an increase of the same amount of lottery fund. Again, no position changes. The next one shifts other funds to Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Funds. This is actually a three-way fund shift, so it would actually reduce general funds and other funds, expenditure limitation, and increase federal funds, but the other funds would be used to backfill unidentified general fund cuts. And as I said, those have not been identified yet, but the expectation is that the agency will be able to locate some general fund expenditures where they could use the freed up other funds. What will happen as a result, though, is that aquatic surveys and fish passage will be affected by the other fund reduction in order to backfill the general fund. And then we get to the general fund hatchery switch to a proposed increase in, or an additional increase in fees, which would take $5 million away from the hatchery program, leaving about $1.5 million of general fund. And the the thinking behind this was that in the long run, it's likely that we're still going to have some problems with funding, even if the general fund does start doing better and we get to the 2005-07 biennium. It's likely that other program areas are probably more likely to get funded and restored with general fund before natural resources does. And so this is an effort to start the discussion about how would you go ahead and make sure that you had stable funding for natural resources in the current environment, but also in the environment that may exist in the future. Other than that, and I'll get into some of the principles that were discussed in coming up with the governor's plan. That was the primary focus for suggesting this. Finally, there is an additional amount for the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund to be used as a way of funding the Oregon Plan monitoring, which was an April 2002 emergency board, and that would continue the Steelhead Coastal and Rogue Coho work. And there are positions associated with that. So there's 29 positions and about 10.12 FTE that would be added to the budget as a result if this were adopted. In summary, real quickly, and then I'll get back to the principles. The governor's recommended budget, or revised budget, excuse me, would be about $9.3 million of general fund as opposed to $15.9 million in the December version. Lottery fund would decrease to about $5.4 million from about $9.3 million in December. Other funds would increase to $101.8 million from about $97 or $98 million. And federal funds would also increase to $102.7 million from about $96 million. The position count would increase from about 1,354 to 1,383, and the FTE count would also increase from 1,105.91 to 1,116.03. The position and FTE changes are only because of that 29 positions for the Oregon Coastal monitoring that I mentioned as the last piece of the revisions to the budget. In terms of principles, the principles, actually there were a number of them, but I'll go over the highlights. The first one was that small agencies would be held harmless. There was some concern that a small agency that had already been cut would no longer be able to function at all if we cut further. That the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund should be used strategically to backfill general fund. This gets into the whole question about the long-term stability of the federal funds and also the discussion about the general fund and the likelihood of this program area being restored when general fund starts returning, considering some of the cuts in the larger policy areas. The PCS, Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund, would be used for wild fish, and that there must be state or auditable outcomes in order to make sure that the federal folks were happy with whatever turned out to be the plan here. That there would be an adequate fund for the OWEB grant program. And that the core parts of the water quality initiatives, the TMDL plans and the Senate Bill 1010 plans, remain general fund. Again, there was some concern about stability, long-term funding, and what would be an appropriate source of funding for those activities. And that pretty much covers the highlights in terms of the principles. And so I would be happy to try and answer any questions that you might have at this point.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa. Was there a discussion of what that $5 million would increase the fees?
Mr. Chair, there wasn't a specific discussion about how much it would be. In fact, the information that the agency handed out I believe yesterday, was the first time that this had actually been calculated out. There were some sort of top of your tongue kind of conversations, but this would be the first time that this was actually calculated out.
Was there any discussion of what plan B would be if we simply couldn't raise fees?
Mr. Chair, I would say that this was a starting point for discussions, and I really don't know what the response would be in terms of a plan B. I think that there was a feeling that you start the discussions, and then if not doable, you talk some more and figure out what you can do. So.
Okay. Any questions, committee? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Mesley. Reclass positions, how many were there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I'm very embarrassed, but my printer did not print my information for me, and so I don't have that handy, but I can bring it back for you. Apparently just one. Okay.
Okay.
I apologize.
And Mr. Chair, I have maybe regarding the budget with the director's up, maybe a question.
I did. Spurned on by Representative Krieger. Could you say what position that is, or your colleague? Whoops. Yeah, time. I was asking for the detail on the reclass, what position it is.
Embarrassing. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'll guess we'll find it when the department comes up.
That's fine. I'll wait. I'm happy to wait.
I'm sorry. We're looking it up right now.
That's fine.
Thank you, Lisa. I want to say that the computer wouldn't print a new one. I'm going to use that one.
Yeah, I made a note of that myself.
That's a really good idea.
Mr. Chair, I need to explain that.
you don't. I'm just kidding.
No offense to Bill Gates, but... the stuff we use, the slides, has a certain amount of space, and I have more notes than would normally be printed, and I would need to technically figure out how to do that. So.
Well, I run into that once in a while, too. My wife tells me I'm a dumb farmer, why I can't make a print.
So, thank you. Director Ball.
You're back.
Chair Meshley, members of the committee, my name is Lindsay Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Chair, if you'd like, we can respond to that reclass position at this time.
That'd be great.
Deanne, please come forward. Deanne DePue will respond to that question from our Administrative Services Division. Deanne?
Chair, Representatives. Deanne DePue, Administrator of Administrative Services Division. This is a part-time clerical staff that works under one of our federal grants. We list that information on page 55. The package number is 260, and it is a support staff for fish screening and passage program. We are reducing months in the position to offset the cost of the reclassification. We don't need as much time, but because of the duties, we need at the higher level.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you.
You have a question.
Yes, Mr. Ball, the Columbia River estuary sturgeon population estimates coastal. Those positions are going to go away, or that effort's going to go away. If I'm reading it right, how does that affect the lawsuit, your ability to, about the listing of the green sturgeon?
Chair Mishley, Representative Krieger, the Columbia River is a project for white sturgeon abundance, not specifically tied to green sturgeon. I believe that is correct. Ed? Is that correct, Ed?
That's the focus, yes.
Yes, that is correct. Okay.
Follow up. In doing one, you get the other, like in the Rogue or the coastal estuaries, for instance.
what's the status of that lawsuit, and are you having to try to find population estimates to show that they're not depleted?
Chair Mishley, if I could call Ed Bowles forward to respond to that question.
We have three chairs, so yeah, that's fine. And would it be better if we let you answer these as we get to the different divisions?
We'll respond to any questions at any time, Mr. Chair. It's your choice.
Okay.
Chair Mishley and Representative Krieger, the project in the Lower Columbia River, focusing on white sturgeon population, which has become a principal fishery in the Columbia River, has been the focus of that effort. The green sturgeon situation with a listing by the federal government is a coast-wide issue up and down the coast. Ed, if you would wish to expound, please do.
Ed Bowles, Fish Division Administrator. And we aren't well-equipped, Representative Krieger, to address all of the green sturgeon needs throughout the state, as you're well aware. Where we are doing it is, as you indicated, is on the backs of some of our other research projects, such as the white sturgeon one. There will be some impacts to our ability to assess the status of green sturgeon with these reductions. But as I said, we're not fully equipped to be addressing those data needs as it is even now.
Well, if you don't have the revenue staff time on sturgeon, it would seem like any of the environmental committee could make a lawsuit against anything. If you don't have staff to handle it, there isn't any way for the department to address the fact that you may have an abundance. You have to prove your innocence, so to speak.
Chair Mezzoli and Representative Krieger, that's correct, not only with respect to potential third-party litigation, but also just with respect to our own policies of being risk-averse under the lack of information. And so what happens in those cases, and it's also evident with many, as you're aware, many of our groundfish stocks, is without adequate information, we tend to manage to the benefit of conservation. Sometimes it turns out unnecessarily, and green sturgeon is one that we just don't quite know yet what the impacts are within the fisheries and even the status of the population.
Very good.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Mr. Chair, we do have responses to three of the questions from yesterday's committee hearing. Mr. Siebert has copies of those responses. The first that I would like to touch upon is a list of FTEs in habitat, staff in agency by division. I'd like to report in the Wildlife Division, there are 61.63 FTEs in field staff, 3 FTEs at the headquarters office. Fish Division has field staff of 15.8 FTEs. Habitat Division has headquarters staff of 9.5 and field staff of 31.5. Providing a breakdown of complaints by species. Mr. Siebert also has a copy of that. The sheet displays a total number of complaints received by the agency throughout the state, and numbers associated with species and total number of animals involved.
Then made Director Ball, Representative Johnson is up to mischief. I can tell by the look on her face.
No, it's just going to bug me so much I won't be able to pay attention to anything else you say. Tell me how these complaints are handled, that somebody calls in and complains about a salamander or a chipmunk. Does somebody respond to this?
Chair Mishley, Representative Johnson, we have a desk manned by two people.
Very patient person.
And those calls come into that person, or they come into an office out in the field. They want to know, what should I do with a salamander in my pantry, or something of that nature. There's a whole myriad of things that happen with respect to wildlife and people when they interact. And
just looking at the species could let your imagination run absolutely wild.
Do you follow up on them? Does somebody, does a caller calls in and says, I have a problem with a chipmunk. Is there an after action, or do you just note it and that move on?
We can advise the person what they can do legally by law, and we also advise them of ways that they can remedy the situation themselves. We also, on nuisance animals such as that, we can give them names of professionals who can assist with that.
One last question. There are two people that man this desk?
No, there's two people at our headquarters office that receive phone calls, thousands of phone calls a week from the general public. And then there are also field offices that have staff that receive phone calls for the complaints as well.
I'm fascinated by this information. I had no idea that went on, that somebody would call about a frog. I mean, it surprises me. Thank you.
22 complaints from bats.
I can understand that.
814 complaints about cougars. 302 complaints of Roosevelt elk, and so on. A lot of times on things like a squirrel complaint or something of that nature, it's because the squirrel has gotten into an attic of a house or has gotten into a food source or something on the back porch, into the bird feeder, you name it. Sometimes we get complaints on flickers that have pecked a hole in the gable of a roof and entered the attic to nest, and the list goes on.
Well, it's changed my whole attitude about quail. Seeing them listed on here as perpetrators, I never thought of them as troublemakers before. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's interesting to note. There are people who call in complaining about the deer in their garden, things of that nature, and I can show you people who have 3 or 4 deer every day bedding down in their garden, and they're just tickled to death to have the deer around, and if they eat some of their garden, that's okay. Another person gets pretty excited about those kinds of things.
Thank you for this educational opportunity.
And it kind of covers the whole spectrum.
Director Ball, I would like to offer on Representative Krieger's behalf and mine that we would be willing to take care of the deer, elk, and mallard duck nuisance if you would exempt us from a few regulations.
Might save you a lot of money.
But a serious question I do have, how do you come up with a dollar loss figure?
Well, that dollar loss figure is sometimes a figure that the person attaches to it and states that's what it cost me and assesses that. We can ask Ron Anglin, our wildlife administrator, to give you more specific information if you'd like.
We can do that when he presents. He will be presenting, right?
Yes, he will.
That's fine. Proceed.
Another request yesterday was providing you a copy of the Cougar Plan. We won't have that information entirely ready for you today. We will have that tomorrow as we work forward in our Cougar Plan process. We will list the goals and accomplishments that we want to attain in our new upcoming Cougar Plan. The other question is, what is the expected reduction in license sales due to a fee increase of $5 million? I have our economist, Dr. Chris Carter, here with us today. If you would like him to come forward, Mr. Chair, we can give you an update on the percentage decrease in that associated with that fee increase.
I'd appreciate that.
Chair Messer, lay members of the committee, my name is Chris Carter. I'm economist for the department. Basically, a license and tag sales depend on a number of things besides fees. Fees are an important determinant. Also, resource conditions. We see license and tag sales increase when more salmon are coming back to the rivers and streams and available in the ocean. The general population level, weather, fire conditions could do it, and over the long haul, tastes and preferences. And all of these things I've modeled from time to time over the years to try to come up with some statistical factors that I use to project declines in sales from fee increases as well as changes in sales from increases in salmon abundance. Under House Bill 2260, my projection was a reduction of about 25,500 anglers if those fees went into effect. That's the fee increase we're asking for, and about 12,800 hunters. Under the additional $5 million increase that's been mentioned in connection with the governor's revised budget, the numbers would go up to 41,400 reduction in annual licenses for fishers or fishermen, and about up a little bit, 15,000 on the hunting side, even though the increase for that last $5 million would be strictly on the fish side. And there'd be a little bit of a change in the hunting side because more of our combination license revenues would go to the fish side because their fees would be then higher. So you're looking at a net difference to add that additional $5 million. You're looking at about 16,000 reduction in annual fishing license holders. And it's a little bit hard to tell on the daily licenses because some of those people who, some of those reductions might shift into dailies. And the way I model dailies is by looking at daily equivalent, one-day equivalent licenses. So some people might go from threes down to twos or fours to threes and so on.
So let me clarify.
The reduction, that was in dollars, or was that in number of licenses?
That's a number of licenses, Mr.
What's
Chairman.
A dollar reduction?
The reduction would actually, since you're talking about raising fees, there would be an increase in revenue. Because in most cases, all the modeling I have done and kind of what you observe over time is that these responses to increases in fees are what are known as inelastic. For example, for a resident angling license, my projection is that a 10% increase in fee would result in a 2.5% decrease in sales. Now, the more you increase your fees, then the greater the increase in sales is going to be downward. But it appears that there's not going to be a reduction in revenue as a result of the increase. Now, having said that, when you project an increase and you're basing your estimates of elasticity on what's happened in the past, you're projecting beyond the limits of your data. And that's probably pretty reasonable for small increases. The larger, I think, you get away from the existing set of data that you have on prices and responses, the more likely you are maybe to be surprised in the future. The other aspect of it is that, of course, resource conditions, I think, and my statistics seem to suggest that resource conditions are the biggest factor influencing whether people buy licenses and tags. And if we were to go into a period where, like we had in the early to mid-90s, with substantial problems with salmon populations, then regardless of what the fees were, you would see some trouble with your revenue based on what where you projected it.
Representative Krueger.
Chair. The original 2260 fee increase was shopped around to the people who were going to buy those licenses throughout the whole state, and a lot of dialogue was done, and for the most part, there are some dubious people out there, but they pretty well stepped up and said that this was their obligation. How do you factor in the fact that this is another fee increase on top of a fee increase? Because I think it's going to have a totally different effect. People are going to say that's enough is enough, so I don't think your figures can take that mindset, hey, we were sold this, we were told this, now we get this. I think you're going to have a backing away more than you might realize.
Mr. Chair, Representative Krueger, I think that's possible. And the reason that I say that is because when I do this modeling, what I'm looking at is going from where we are now to where we are going to be. So in the one case, the first projection on House Bill 2260 was going from where we are now to there. With the additional $5 million, it's based on going from fees where we are now out to here. And so it really doesn't look at the effect of kind of the psychological effect of telling people that you're going to go from place A to B and instead you go from A to C.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a credibility thing that they're going to feel that they've been, you know, we as legislator or the department haven't been upright with them, which in my opinion isn't good because this department spent the last 2 years getting its credibility back. This isn't going to help.
Okay. Any other questions? That's it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Mishley, members of the committee, I've asked our first presenter on the division topics to be Ron Anglin from our Wildlife Division. We will then move back to Ed Bowles and have Habitat Division, and we'll see how far we get today through our agenda. So the next presenter will be Ron Anglin from our Wildlife Division.
Good afternoon, Chair Meserly, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. The section on the Wildlife Division begins on page 57 of the department's manual that's in front of you. The Wildlife Division is one of the two divisions that's created by statute, as mentioned by Director Ball yesterday, and basically consists of two sections. It consists of the headquarters operations and our field operations. In headquarters, we have a total of 17 FTE that oversee the total management of programs around the state, ensuring continuity, taking the lead on revision of management plans and responding to special requests. And then there's a total of about 231 positions that are located out in field operations that carry out the day-to-day implementation of our agency and its programs. Page 58 lists the three primary program sections that are found within the Wildlife Division: the game program, the federal aid landowner assistance program, and the wildlife diversity program. The game program consists, is funded primarily by other fund and federal fund with some general fund thrown in. It's in this section that the damage, most of our damage activities occur, dealing with landowners. And in response to Representative Johnson's question earlier, we rely on the landowner to provide us with an estimate of what those damages actually cost. And that can range from the cost of replacing an ornamental tree to the cost of repairing siding on a house, depending on the species of bear, getting into a beehive, something like that. So we rely entirely on the landowner to provide us with that estimate, Representative.
If I may, along those lines, Mr. Anglin, I noticed very low, unless I missed one someplace, very low damage figures for geese. I do see one, Canadian geese. I did miss that one. But it still seems quite low when you look at the amount of pasture and hay damage and things that I hear about, at least. Is it just this is a figure only from the complaints and not necessarily a total figure of damage throughout the state?
Chair Messerly, that's correct. We have a lot of landowners that have, they tolerate the amount of damage that they get. They don't necessarily like it. These are only the complaints that are logged with us as an agency. I might also point out that the complaints that you have are the ones that come directly to us. There are also damage complaints collected through Wildlife Services that are not reflected in this. Wildlife Services deals with a lot of the waterfowl complaints, depending on the portion of the state that they're in. And then we also work with OFIC. They collect a lot of damage estimates and complaints within their own membership.
So are these complaints only that you hear about directly at the headquarters, or do they come from the field as well?
Chair Messerly, these come directly from the field to headquarters. This is all handled at the local level.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Following on that same line of questioning, I know that animal damage, it's not ADC, it's Wildlife Services,
right,
that they collect data, and just as you said, there are other collection points.
Does anybody ever gather that information so that you get a larger picture? And what I'm getting at is I represent an agricultural area that has huge geese complaints. I can't do a town hall that I don't have somebody coming and talking about the damage that Canadian geese do. What I'm trying to find out is if there's a correlation between gathering this information and instruction about a course of action. Whether or not the complaints would be so large if all of the information is correlated that it would in effect be a call to action to either the federal government or to you all to do something.
Chair Messerly, Representative Johnson, we in fact have called to action on the goose problem in Northwest, and we've done that because we have worked with Wildlife Services to consolidate those complaints and have elevated it within the federal government to the point where in the past they have provided us with special funding to conduct special hunting seasons and extended seasons. We recognize that, and it was recognized in the last session, that there has not been a consolidation of damage complaints within the agency amongst some of the different organizations that are out there. And a little later in my presentation, I was going to discuss the Wildlife Damage Council that met during the course of this last year and some of the things that were discussed in that on ways to move forward to gain a better consolidation of all of that and the ongoing efforts to do that.
Good. I'll hold the rest of my questions till you get to that part. Thanks.
The game program itself is primarily responsible for doing all the inventory of the various huntable species of the state. We do 100% of inventory of the 80 species that are hunted. We have been actively involved in research with the Elk Nutrition Project, some cougar projects in southwestern Oregon, some bear projects that are devised to provide us with population estimates. We have a long going and what we consider a huge success story in our bighorn sheep restoration program, where we took a species that was extinct from the state, reintroduced it, and is being held up across the West as a model of how to go about reconstructing a population. We are actively involved in sage grouse and mountain quail work that some of our preliminary efforts have led the federal government to decide not to move forward with listing efforts on mountain quail in eastern Oregon, and have served as a strong basis for some of the information they're considering relative to sage grouse also in eastern Oregon. In the federal aid landowner assistance program, this is our old habitat program within the Wildlife Division. This oversees the 13 wildlife management areas that we have manned across the state. These were set up for a variety of reasons, some of them to alleviate damage within the local area by attracting big game or waterfowl onto wildlife areas and trying to minimize impacts to private land. They also provide a huge amount of recreational opportunity for hunting and angling, and more recently we're seeing an increase in non-consumptive uses on our wildlife areas, primarily viewing, to the point that last year it was estimated we had about 2 million user days on our wildlife areas. Also within this section is the major programs that work with private landowners to try and improve forage conditions for deer and elk on those lands where landowners want to do that. We also have the ability to work with federal agencies to try and improve forage on federal lands to keep big game on federal lands and not cause those impacts on private lands. And we work closely with private landowners to secure access for hunters across the state in a variety of different areas. The Wildlife Diversity Program is the other major program that we have within the Wildlife Division. It's funded primarily by general fund, wildlife diversity checkoff dollars, and some federal dollars that are either a 25-75% match or a 100% grant to the agency. The Wildlife Diversity Program has suffered from a lack of funding during the last 10 years. We've seen a decrease in general fund and of checkoff dollars during that time, and this has corresponded in a direct decrease in the number of species that we've been able to inventory and monitor. We're able today to monitor about 46 of the 557 species that are classified in the Wildlife Diversity Program, which represents about 8% of the total program. This is a huge concern to us, and we're working to try and secure other funds that will allow us to expand those monitoring efforts and potentially to head off problems before they arise. Some of the key issues that are facing the agency is found on page 59. I already mentioned the funding for the Wildlife Diversity Program. The same thing holds true for the game program. Loss of funding correlates to a loss in putting people on the ground and being able to provide services to landowners and to provide services to the recreational constituents that we have within the agency. I've also already mentioned the sage grouse and mountain quail work that we're doing, and as I said earlier, and actually the mountain quail, we have expanded that in our research efforts to where we are releasing birds in eastern Oregon. We're catching mountain quail down out of Roseburg. We're releasing birds in eastern Oregon with radio transmitters on them to be able to identify what are the types of habitats that they are seeking out for nesting and rearing and then over winter survival. And we can use that information to identify and target areas in the future that have those similar habitat component types that we can go back then and work to reestablish populations where they used to exist and they no longer are found. So that's pretty cutting edge here in the West. The Fish and Wildlife Service has told Idaho and Washington that this is a model they should be following, and we're pretty proud of that effort that we're out in the lead on that. The Wildlife Damage Advisory Council was formed during the last legislative session. It was jointly chaired by Department of Ag and ODFW. The members of the committee, the council, were selected by the directors of the two agencies, and we have met several times during the off session and come up with a series of recommendations that have been made to the two agency directors, and they'll be presented to the House Natural Resources and Ag Committee either next week or the week after. And in that, one of the major topics of discussion was how to go about consolidating the information located within Wildlife Services, OFIC, and the department in a usable format so that we can show from a damage standpoint what the impact wildlife are having across the broad landscape. And that is something that we haven't accomplished yet, but it is something that you'll see OFIC and the Wildlife Services representatives and ODFW working on in the next few months to come up with a method of doing just exactly that. It was also identified within this council the importance that private lands play to wildlife and wildlife management and wildlife species. And there was strong support by landowners for the agency's landowner assistance programs. There was support for the access and habitat program. There was support for the landowner preference program. And those were all viewed as proactive ways that we can assist private landowners, recognizing that it's not always enough, but recognizing that it's certainly a big jump ahead from where we were 10, 15 years ago, and the landowners truly appreciate the efforts that we've been able to make in helping them out in those manners.
I wonder, Mr. Anglet, are you seeing any problems with some operations that have started raising exotic species of deer or other types of animals as far as containing them? And I'm not referring to the elk ranching, but I know there's some other operations that I know of that used to be in my old district that are in Representative Krieger's district where, you know, they had several hundred acres, but they fenced it and then they had exotic species from all over the world, I think. Is that working out? Are they able to manage that, or does that eventually turn into a problem for the department?
Chair Messerly, in general, things have worked out fairly well with those operations. While there are escapes, they appear to be relatively minor. Certainly the operator doesn't want their animals getting out because they have a value, and we don't always hear about an escape in a very prompt manner, but in general we don't appear to be having a lot of problem with that.
Representative Krieger.
Who's in Curry County, if something escapes out of a fence, its lifespan is short.
Probably enough said.
One other question I have.
You got more to say.
Yeah. What was the figure? 2 million viewing days at your facilities, or hours, or what was it?
Chair Messerly, Representative Krieger, it's 2 million user days, and that includes hunters, anglers, and people that just come in from a non-consumptive standpoint and a viewing standpoint.
That would include hatcheries where the kids come from the schools, the school buses, and go through a hatchery tour, that type of thing. Is that included in that number?
Chair Messerly, Representative Krieger, no, that's just our wildlife management areas. When you think of an area like Savis Island, and the huge amount of people in the summertime that go out along the Columbia onto the beaches, the number of people that are coming into Klamath Wildlife Area, Summer Lake Wildlife Area in the spring to see geese and the migrating birds, just from a non-consumptive standpoint, it's a huge building industry that we certainly have the ability to encourage from a local economy standpoint. We probably have not done everything that we could do, and we've been talking internally about what are some ways we can promote that even further. Wildlife diseases are a huge concern for us as an agency, and that is something that would also cross-reference back, Chair Messerly, to your previous question relative to exotic animals that are brought into some of these facilities. I know in some cases where we have had escapees, primarily of feral hogs, there is a huge concern about disease transmission and habitat destruction that occur from the hogs. And typically those diseases the pigs are fairly resistant to, but they can cause some pretty far-reaching impacts, not only to wildlife but also to other livestock. There are some other diseases that seem to be at the forefront today. That's chronic wasting disease. Unfortunately, like Washington, we now have deer hair loss in Oregon spreading down the coast and into the Willamette Valley. Everybody's probably heard of West Nile virus. These are things that are staring us in the face, have impacted specifically deer hair loss has impacted survival of black-tailed deer in western Oregon, and it's a huge concern to us. We're looking at some research opportunities along with Washington and potentially with some private partners to try and address that and look at ways that to fully understand what's causing this and see if there's a way that we can possibly contain it.
Representative Johnson?
I was just thinking, Mr. Chair, just curious about that, only because we had an animal die just outside my office that appeared to have big bunches of hair gone. Are you suggesting that was some kind of an imported disease that has spread into our native Oregon herds, or is it environmental? Do you have any idea what the source of that disease is?
Chair Messerly, Representative Johnson, the actual cause of the disease is a louse, and it causes, with a huge infestation, it causes the hair to fall out, and the animal then becomes very susceptible to pneumonia and other problems, and survival, especially of fawns, really goes down. We have never documented it in Oregon until the last few years. It first showed up in the Coast Range of northern Washington, and it appeared to just progress down the coast. Every year it was a little closer to Oregon until finally a few years ago it was found in northwestern Oregon, and it's continued to progress southward. It's now down fairly common down in the areas around Alsea, Walport, down towards Florence.
Well, are there reporting requirements for that? Because we just had one of the fellows that works nearby put the animal down when it was clear that it was not well. Is that something that we should have reported?
Chair Messerly, Representative Johnson, no, it really wouldn't do anything for us as far as tracking where the disease is, because we know it is located in your particular area. Usually when it shows up in a new area, it's so odd looking that we do get reports of it, and those are very valuable for us for tracking the progression of the disease. In answer to your question on whether it's an introduced exotic or it's an environmental factor, we don't know that answer 100% for sure. There are some major research efforts going on out of Washington and looking at all of those factors, whether with the drought conditions and the warming that we've had, if it's allowed a life cycle of the louse to survive because the winters aren't cold enough and all of a sudden it's having an impact on the deer. You know, has it been here all the time and now all of a sudden it's causing a problem, or was it in fact introduced? And those are some things that current research is looking into, and trying to identify the exact species of lice that's causing this, and from that there's hope that they'll be able to determine on whether it is a native species or it's been introduced with something else. Some of the research that's going on has found, though, that there's not a whole awful lot of louse experts in the United States anymore, and finding people that can make these determinations has been difficult.
Thank you.
Are they able to respond or build resistance and survive, or will it eventually just draw them down to die?
Chair Messerly, early on in the cycle, what everybody has told us is that you will have a very high mortality of the young and of those that are weak for whatever reason. In time, they may build some resistance to it, but it draws them down enough that if environmental conditions are such that they can get pneumonia or become more susceptible to other diseases, and it's very difficult for them to resist that, and it can be have a pretty detrimental overall impact and effect on the population.
Okay. Chair Messerly and Representative Johnson, for clarification, it's permissible for a citizen to dispatch a game animal for humane purposes, but shortly right after that, you're supposed to immediately contact either the state police or Department of Fish and Wildlife to report that, just for your reference.
Thank you. I'm glad to know that.
That's the way they do it in Curry County.
Yeah, I know. I sit next to him.
Finally, the remaining key issue that is facing the agency right now today is the fact that we will have wolves dispersing from Idaho into Oregon, and the agency recognizes that we need to have a plan on how to deal with those. The commission has directed us to undertake a planning process, and we'll be starting on that in the very near future. We also have before you, as mentioned yesterday, House Bill 2258, which extends the fee for the Access and Habitat Program. This, as mentioned earlier, the Wildlife Damage Council felt that there was a lot of value to support the continuance of that, and we have received a lot of positive comments about what that program has actually done. I think it's real key that during this last biennium, we were able to open up a little over 800,000 acres of private lands for access to the hunting public, and we were able to make some positive habitat improvements on a little over 150,000 acres. We also had the ability to, through some special rule language from the commission last fall, to respond very quickly to some reseeding efforts on private lands as a result of the catastrophic fires that were suffered in not only southwestern Oregon, but also in eastern Oregon. And the landowners were very appreciative of the fact that we were able to assist them with getting some grass seed out on the ground very quickly to stabilize soils and to minimize some of those long-term impacts. On page 60, as mentioned earlier, there's some of the reductions that the Wildlife Division has taken as a result of the several special sessions that have recently passed. The main impact is we've had one position cut in headquarters that dealt primarily with permitting functions of the Wildlife Division. This program or this person worked directly with the wildlife rehabbers and scientific take permit, falconry licenses, things like that. We've had to shift those responsibilities that are required by statute onto other personnel to pick up the slack. We also have eliminated some of our field assistance to landowners through the Green Forage Program, and we eliminated one diversity position from northwestern Oregon. Pages 61 through 63 describe the various agencies that we work with from a service delivery standpoint. I think that it's real important to note that I've seen a good improvement in a working relationship with the Oregon Department of Ag during this last session, or the last 2 years, that both of us have started working real closely together on animal health issues, and we've formed some really strong alliances that have been a benefit to the state. And also that with Department of Forestry, we're one of the state agencies that is also tied into their radio network, and we've had a long-standing agreement with them to supply equipment and personnel where needed and where possible during fire season that would help them out on a fire itself. And a lot of this are our field staff working off of wildlife management areas and out of the various regions. Moving ahead to page 64, the factors affecting service delivery, I would say that the biggest thing that faces us is the long-term stability of funding within the Wildlife Diversity Program and being able to respond to the multitude of species needs there that at this point in time we're unable to get to. And we have some concerns there that we can't answer until we're able to secure funds that allow us to do that. With that, Chair, I'd like to conclude my presentation.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Committee? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, our next presenter will be Mr. Ed Bowles, our Fish Division Administrator.
Chair Mezzoli and committee members, my name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator. And I think you know the Fish Division section is outlined in pages 43 through 55 of the Ways and Means document. As Director Ball mentioned yesterday, Fish Division as well as Wildlife Division is mandated under state statute to protect, manage, and enhance the fishery resources for the benefit of Oregon citizens and their communities. Now, we separate this benefit into two primary areas. First is to provide fish for society to catch, harvest, and view, but it's also to maintain healthy native fish populations in their habitats. Oregon's sport and commercial fisheries generate approximately $460 million annually in personal income impacts and over 8 million days of recreational angling each year. This economic impact is particularly important in helping shift urban wealth to rural communities associated with Oregon's rivers, lakes, and coastal areas. As you're well aware, fishing is a favorite recreational activity for Oregonians and a vital part of our Northwest heritage. It is also a very important component of tribal culture and subsistence.
maintaining healthy native fish populations and their habitats really provides the foundation for all of these benefits. And it requires successfully balancing the needs of the fish with other societal values. And also requires having adequate monitoring so that we can evaluate this in order to move forward and meet the needs of federal and state regulators. Now, being able to address these fishery and conservation benefits is quite a large task. Fish Division is the largest component of the agency, as Director Ball mentioned yesterday. It accounts for over 70% of the positions and over half of the expenditures. Most of these positions and spending are associated with field operations, supervised and administered out of the regions. And so we've only got about 6% of Fish Division out of headquarters, and the rest of it is field-oriented. Now, we've got four major program areas outlined in the Ways and Means document: propagation, natural production, marine resources, and interjurisdictional fisheries. The propagation and natural production programs are the two largest and account for over 75% of Fish Division's workforce and expenditures. I'll first talk about the fish propagation program. It operates administers 34 hatcheries and 15 satellite facilities. That includes the STEP and CEDC programs, as well as the Yquinna Bay Acclimation Facility. These operations release over 50 million salmon, steelhead, and trout into Oregon waters each year. We also pay private trout producers to supply 10% of the state-funded annual trout production. And then this program also has our fish health section in it and our engineering section. I'd like to mention that over
Mr. Chair, before we move on, I want to talk a little bit about the private trout producers. I'm making the assumption that when you shop for stocks of fish, that the type of fish is important, price is important. I appreciate the fact that there appears to be this 10%. Is all this Oregon, or do you shop for private producers any place you look?
Chair Measurely and Representative Johnson, we are required to provide money to buy 10% of our total production from private producers. We actually have encouraged, right now there is a single vendor, if you will, a producer that gets that 10% at Desert Springs. We have encouraged, as well as that particular producer has encouraged, other producers to compete for this service and these monies. Right now, because of some contracting limitations and as well as delivery issues, water quality issues and others, they have not competed successfully for those. And so we're limited to the one. We certainly would encourage other producers to get involved in this competitively.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I understand the interest in wanting to acquire Oregon stock and produced from these private producers. But are there other vendors available nationwide where you could seek a competitive price and the kind of stocks that were attractive to your breeding programs or your propagation programs?
Chair Mezzoli and Representative Johnson, yes, there are. Both Idaho and Washington, as well as California, have private trout producers.
And how much money is expended in this expenditure line item that you have? How much money are you spending?
Chair Mezzoli and Representative Johnson, it's just shy of $280,000 per buying them.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Mishley, Representative Johnson, in addition to that, during the 01-03 biennium, there was money appropriated to purchase trout for Diamond Lake as well. That money is not included in the governor's balanced budget or the governor's revised budget.
Question, Mr. Chair. There was money to purchase trout for Diamond Lake, not otherwise specified. Just go find some trout at a competitive price that would be acceptable in that aquifer or that in that lake.
Chair Mishley, Representative Johnson, that is correct. There was a special provision in a line item in the 0103 budget of ODFW to ensure that trout would be provided for Diamond Lake. Since the lake was invaded by tui chub from an illegal transplant, bolstering trout planting in that lake beyond what ODFW had originally planned was looked to be as an economic incentive to attract people to the lake and camp and use the lodge facilities that were there.
Thank you.
Chair, I'll continue. Over 70% of all fish caught, these are some monids caught by recreational anglers, are hatchery produced. So I want to accentuate the importance of the hatchery program. It provides over $200 million in personal income benefits to Oregon annually. As Representative Krieger mentioned earlier, we also have many visitors enjoying and touring Oregon's hatcheries each year. That's over 1.4 million visitor days. The hatchery program is at a crossroads. I think all of you are aware of this. Hatcheries of the past were provided primarily to help harvest, light harvest opportunities. There really was not major concerns about natural production or the ecological impacts. Expectations for hatcheries are quite different today. In addition to the traditional harvest role, hatcheries may now be expected to enhance the wild fish numbers themselves or to provide a genetic refuge. Hatcheries are also expected to avoid harming the watersheds in which they reside. By this I mean reducing solid and chemical waste, fish passage, avoiding invasive species. Now, these changing expectations are progressive and necessary, and I believe we are making some rapid strides toward meeting the hatchery challenge. I'd like to give you one example, and that's the native fish conservation policy, which was adopted November of last year, which Director Ball touched on. This new approach recognizes the importance and role of hatcheries, but it focuses in on ensuring that we've got recovery of our naturally produced stocks. And we're just completing a companion policy called the Hatchery Management Policy. That's slated for consideration by our commission this next month. And that describes the hatchery tool and its range of applications. These two combined, I think, will be foundational for how we move forward in meeting the new challenges, both for fish recovery and the responsible use of hatcheries. Another key element in our continued progress is another issue that Director Ball brought up and I think will be discussed further tomorrow, and that's the Fall Creek Hatchery Research Center. And this center, I think, would really reinforce Oregon's scientific leadership and help guide us in both hatchery reform as well as recovery issues. An ongoing challenge for our hatcheries is a deferred maintenance issue. As required in a budget note, the deferred maintenance report, and as I understand it, I'm not sure the committee actually has copies of the report, but we did bring copies, and they are available. So I'm not sure how much time you've had to review that, Chair. But this report, I think, describes our maintenance backlog very well and gives us some solid footing for us to work with all potential funding sources to try to get a handle on these maintenance needs and a firm strategy of how to move forward and reduce this burden. I'd like to switch next to the natural production program. This is vital to both fishing and conservation. It has six primary functions: support and help implement the Oregon Plan for salmon and watersheds, and that includes our native fish conservation policy. It also manages our freshwater fish, which is really setting the regulations and dealing with the day-to-day management. Dealing with ESA issues, both permitting and review, and recovery plans. It supports the STEP and R&E programs. Conducts research and monitoring and administers the fish screening and passage programs. Now, although the natural production program has had numerous successes this biennium, I'd like to focus on one area again. This is the native fish conservation policy. Really just want to bring up that this really provides a scientific basis and foundation for how we're going to move forward in addressing limiting factors and using the Oregon Plan to help recover Oregon's native fish species. And the success of this policy, or it's been well enough received right now that I think it's quite indicative that we've got NOAA fisheries, as well as the governor's office now, that have approved under our department's leadership kind of a test drive of this policy for coastal coho in order to try to expedite a recovery plan and potentially expedite delisting consideration. We're very excited about being able to provide some leadership on that. I'd like to shift now to the Marine Resources Program. This program helps protect and manage Oregon's marine fish and shellfish. These resources provide tremendous economic benefits, as you're well aware, over $200 million in personal income to local and state economies. The Marine Program focuses on research, stock assessment, fisheries monitoring, and management activities to support numerous commercial and recreational fisheries. As Representative Krieger brought up yesterday, research is really key to the success of many of these fisheries in the program, because without information, we cannot move forward and with harvest as well as conservation needs. This program also represents Oregon in numerous interjurisdictional fishery forums that span different states and governmental groups. The Marine Program is headquartered in Newport. It has offices in Astoria, Tillamook, Charleston, as well as Brookings. I think this has really fostered a close working relationship with the constituents. The Marine Program has taken a leadership role in helping address the groundfish crisis, and you've seen some of the effects of this in the legislature this session and last session. We're trying to provide good quality scientific information, helping adapt fishing techniques in light of some of these weak groups of fish. We're helping shift nearshore management from the federal government to the state, and working closely with coastal communities and the fishing industry in an attempt to lessen the hardships of the groundfish crisis. The fourth program that we have is the Interjurisdictional Fisheries Program.
If I could break in, Mr. Wolf. Are we seeing any increase in the amount of research done by the federal agencies? No.
Chair Miserly, the amount of dollars dedicated for research has increased for assessments, particularly with respect to the groundfish crisis, but it still is inadequate to truly get out ahead of some of the needs, and so fisheries are having to be shut, you know, ratcheted down accordingly. And you've seen that with what is going on right now with the Pacific Fish Management Council.
Even beyond the assessments, is there more research being done on just what's going on in the food chains and their interreactions?
Chair Miserly, I guess I'd call that kind of basic research, getting to understand the fish and their habitats a little better. There is money available to that, but it's very limited. And our staff is moving forward on some of that as well. We are also looking for other alternative funding sources, grants and others, to try to help out with some of that basic research needs. Some of these groundfish stocks are very long-lived, and we don't even know very well where that life is spent and how much movement they have and how successful their reproduction is.
Thanks.
The interjurisdictional program assesses the status of salmon, steelhead, sturgeon, and smelt populations and manages Columbia River, ocean, and coastal fisheries for these species. By nature of the name, these fisheries have multiple jurisdictions, and it's both state, tribal, federal, and international parties. A couple examples, Columbia River Compact, USB Oregon, Pacific Fish Management Council, and the International Pacific Salmon Treaty. It also represents both our agency and the state in Columbia River fish recovery issues, dealing with hydro system operations, sub-basin planning, and working closely with the Northwest Power Planning Council and the Governor's Office on those fronts. That's all I'd like to present formally to you today. I think Fish Division is quite optimistic about the future of both fish and fishing in Oregon, and pretty excited at being able to take a leadership role in this. Certainly some significant challenges for us, though.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Ed, I want to talk about a little bit more. You indicated that 70% of our catchable fish, salmon, from hatchery origin, something of that nature. And then you went on to say $200 million. And then when you went on to say 1.4 million visitor days at facilities, the question has come up, what value do the hatcheries have? How should they be funded? Is it appropriate for it to be general fund money? I think you've set the foundation that the general fund should be funding these hatcheries, because a lot of non-consumptive Oregonians, including thousands and thousands of school kids, go to those hatcheries. My grandchildren just went to one at Elk River. They also had a fish day there. We've got $200 million. If you just took the 9% Oregon tax on that, it's almost double what the hatcheries are costing us. I think they serve a real benefit to Oregon beyond the consumptive angler. They also are the tool that has the genetics from hatchery to hatchery that you may at one time need to do recovery. Right? Yes?
Chair Mazzoli and Representative Krieger, I think there's probably a question somewhere in there, but those statements are
reaffirm what I'm saying.
Well, thumbs up on that, right?
That's probably good enough.
You agree.
Let's see what I can agree with. Yes, the hatches are very important to not only these communities, but also to the fisheries. They do have a lot of visitors that are non-consumptive types, educational purposes. We view them not just as educational with respect to hatcheries, but also educational with respect to the functions of the ecosystems and fish protection and conservation as well. A lot of these facilities have interpretive centers associated with them and kiosks that are very informational on the Oregon plan and all aspects of fish stewardship. As far as the economics, certainly the economics of these fisheries support go beyond just fishermen. There is also the economies that these hatcheries support that are commercially oriented as well, that are not fee-based or license-based. So there are a lot of policy issues related to the hatcheries that certainly is not just a sport fish issue.
I'd like to just expand a little bit beyond Representative Krieger. I think we talked about this a little bit yesterday, but the society as a whole really has a stake in the recovery of these fisheries. When you look at the impacts of the listings of the endangered species and what that does to road building, the economy getting employment in the state and right on down the line, it is a huge factor that we resolve these endangered species issues and getting our economy back in place. So I share the representative's concern that we're putting too much of the burden on the backs of the horse fishermen, basically, and some commercial. You agree with that? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, if I might add to that, with the governor's revised budget, the governor is looking for sources of funds to balance the state's budget on priorities and programs that are essential to the core of Oregonians. And as I think Lisa Pearson mentioned in the start, the revised budget is a discussion point. There might be some other solutions out there that we have yet to discuss and look at. I think we're all ears to any suggestions or thoughts on that topic. $5 million is scheduled to come out of the hatchery program with a thought possibly we could raise fees. That's where we are today back to the revised budget, sir.
Okay, thank you. What's next? Thank you, Ed.
Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, the next presenter will be Dave McAllister from our Habitat Division.
Good afternoon. Chair Mezzerly, members of the committee, Dave McAllister, Habitat Division Administrator of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. My presentation begins on page 67 of the budget document. The Habitat Division is an administrative unit of the agency organized to support fish and wildlife statutes and rules of the state. The department, as you may be aware, has very little regulatory authority over fish and wildlife habitat. Most of the authority resides in other agency statutes with strong direction to consult with the department. And if you'll look on page 68, on the right-hand margin, there are a variety of those statutes that require or strongly encourage this consultation. The division provides efficiencies in dealing with this consultation role and other habitat issues. It does this in very specific ways. It works with the public and private sector clients to develop mutually satisfactory solutions to both fish and wildlife habitat issues. It develops a comprehensive habitat policy and standards to increase consistency among field staff and divisions regarding fish and wildlife habitat issues. It provides policy and statewide habitat issue analysis that is at a scale that goes beyond individual watershed districts and regions and beyond individual fish or wildlife issues. And finally, it maintains a standardized, comprehensive, and retrievable fish, wildlife, and habitat database to assist in informed decision-making. We have two program areas in the division. There is the land resource program area. It deals with agency consultation. It provides assistance to landowners through cooperative partnerships, and we have also our tax incentive programs based in that area. And we deal with our natural resource damage assessment activities out of that program. On the water resources side, we also do our agency consultation, and we have our hydro program located there. And I'll speak to that in a moment in more detail. And we have our natural resource information management program. There is a GIS element to that, which is the way we manage our database within our database on natural resources within the agency. Several key issues I'd like to point out for you today. We are going through a lot of hydro relicensing. There are 10 facilities currently going through relicensing. Two of those are decommissioning projects. Additionally, there's 30 small hydro projects that are under licenses that the ODFW consults on, and 40 additional micro hydro licenses that also require a consultation. Might also add that the department staff are exploring new ways to encourage participation in landowner incentive programs and to promote conservation and protection of fish and wildlife habitats. And there was a bill last session, 3564, that was task force to look into this. We have been actively participating in that task force, and I think out of the task force there is a House bill that is introduced this session, House Bill 3616. I mentioned that we have two programs. They're tax incentive programs. One's the Wildlife Habitat Conservation Program, and the other is the Riparian Tax Incentive Program. Mr. Chair, I'm happy to announce that the division was the recent recipient of a $1.5 million grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's called the Landowner Incentive Program. Upon receipt of those funds into our budget, we'll be able to fund 15 different habitat incentive projects throughout the state. Those projects, I might add, were done through a competitive process and required a good deal of match on the part of the participants. So we're very happy with that program. Finally, I mentioned that our database facility here at the in the agency. One of the things I might make note to the committee is that we have the StreamNet function that's there. And if you've ever had the opportunity, go to our website and go to that area, and you can now bring up maps of fish distribution throughout the state. Anadromous fish is what we have in there now. We have some barrier information on impediments to fish flows and fish distribution, but nonetheless, it's a start, and we're working on improving that continually. Below on page 69, there is a discussion of our budget. In the 2003-2005 governor's balanced budget, I think it's worth noting to the committee that the other funds that are identified for this particular division are really not tied to the fee bill. Most of our other funds, and generally almost all of our funds, are either contract services, either from the hydro program water resources. We have them with the Department of Forestry and with the Oregon Department of Transportation.
You have almost 33 FTE in your department, is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
How many habitat personnel are in the other two divisions, habitat and fisheries?
Well, the information that Director Ball provided you today, there was 15.8 FTE in the fish division and 64.63 in the wildlife division.
And what was that last figure?
I'm sorry?
What was that last figure?
A total, including both field and headquarters staff in the wildlife division, of 64.63.
How does your department relate to the habitat staff and the other divisions?
The habitat staff within the habitat division is functions differently in that their emphasis area is different in their field activities. The wildlife habitat staff, a large portion of that staff is our management areas, and they're interested in damage complaints and other direct wildlife-related activities. The habitat staff in the habitat division works principally on partnering with landowners, habitat improvement projects. We provide technical assistance to the districts on project-related impacts from development actions and the like.
Thank you. Although, I'm just looking at the handout from the director earlier. If I'm reading this wrong, is that there's 41 FTE in the habitat division, and as I look on the organization chart on page 67, that's 32.92.
Mr. Chair, let me explain. The discrepancy that you see there, my understanding is the question that you asked Director Ball to report back to you on was the number of FTE that we had in the field currently. There are those additional biologists that are in the stream restoration program, and they weren't included in the 03-05 budget, in our base budget, and so we included them in the description provided for you, but they wouldn't be reflected in the status.
So where would they show up then in our book here?
I think earlier in the document, at least on the budget size, we note that it was the program was recommended from our perspective in the 03-05 budget, and then it was zeroed in the governor's balanced budget. I think that's the only where we don't show any of the FTE per se, just the budget numbers. But that roughly translates to the number of individuals that are actively in the program. There will be one remaining position that is funded through the Department of Forestry if we don't secure funds in the 03-05 budget for those activities.
Mr. Chair, make sure your answer was your question was answered. You asked if those positions were included in the 03-05, where would they reside? Is that correct? Where would they reside, Dave?
Mr. Chair, they would be in the Habitat Division. Just as they have been for the last two bienniums, previous bienniums.
So let me be clear here. What we're seeing in the book is a reduction of 8.5 Habitat Division employees.
Yes.
Mostly in the headquarters staff?
Mr. Chair, no, those would be field staff positions.
Okay. Confused. This sheet shows 31.5 field staff.
That's correct. You would subtract the 8.5 from there, and you should have the number that is the correct amount for the field positions.
Thank you.
Going to page 71, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are the service delivery areas. There's a range of various agencies that we work with. I'd like to point out one specifically, the Department of Forestry. For the last 2 years, many of you are aware that the Department of Forestry has been involved in development of the Northwest Forest Plan on the Tillamook Classical Forest. That particular plan, we have worked with the Department of Forestry, and they have essentially assigned us to write both the aquatic conservation strategy and the wildlife protection strategies for the plan. And we have done so, and I think they have shown that we can harvest timber and protect fish and wildlife habitat at the same time. Might add that we're also working right now with the department on their habitat conservation plan for that particular area with the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries. Moving on to page 73, I would just mention, emphasize again, as I mentioned previously, other states do not maintain fish and wildlife staff. They rely on ODFW to provide that expertise. Their issues are habitat-related, often regulatory issues, and the staff from the Habitat Division is specialized in these kind of issues, and they can respond to the needs. Generally under the auspices of the Oregon Plan is the way we operate. And one other thought on this, one area that is a potential for duplication, we have a variety of these different management areas for data, natural resource information. We have OWEB currently. There is the State Service Center. Oregon State University has some interest in establishing that database. Frankly, there is the potential for duplication here that we need, I think, to see if we can resolve this in the future. Factors affecting service delivery are generally fee-based. We do lack staff. There are a lot of important issues out there, and we can't seem to meet the needs of everyone to the extent that we'd like.
Let me ask you about, did you just say fee-based? Some of your...
Excuse me, did I say funding-based? I apologize. Thank you.
Well, maybe that's what I was thinking, because that's where I want to go.
Yeah.
You provide a lot of services to local government, DLCD, Division of State Lands. Has there ever been a discussion about any kind of a fee for that kind of service?
Chair Meserle, not to my knowledge. A little history, if I may. Back in the early 90s, there was that period of time, I think, when there was a lot of interest in environmental regulations and protection. And the agency at that time made a specific choice not to seek funding for any sort of fee-based participation, but work more to get the participation role in those statutes of the other agencies. And so that was really the genesis of it, and we haven't pursued an alternative to that yet.
Part of the reason I want to raise that issue, and we can pursue that as we work through work sessions. Division State Lands funding comes out of the Common School Fund, so that's not general fund monies. But there is a mix of, such as ODOT pays for some of Division of State Lands staff. They're paying for some other staff and other agencies where they're shifting funds. There are other funds that are helping reduce the demand on general funds. I would assume that
your habitat funds are also general funds, most of them.
That's a large part of those are general funds, and we have these other contract services. Let me elaborate a little bit, Mr. Chair. The ODOT, and I made a distinction between the agency that's regulating, for instance, the Division of State Lands. Now, ODOT is a client in the sense that they are looking for a permit and assistance, technical assistance on that. ODOT has entered an agreement. It's one of those other fund sources I refer to. They have contracted for three of our biologists specifically to do that. The Department of Forestry has also done that, and so we work on the behalf to secure permits, make it more efficient for them to get the permits and provide the technical information they need to get those permits.
That's helpful. Thank you. Okay. Sir Director, what do you think?
How long do you want to stay, sir?
About four more minutes. Would you like to make a break now?
Well, I just got told, Mr. Chair.
That's a yes, Mr. Chair.
It's a good place to break.
Mr. Chair, that concludes today. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.
And what do we have up tomorrow? Administration.
We'll start with administration. Administration, Fish and Wildlife Enforcement, and Capital Improvement.
So we should be able to get through tomorrow quite easily.
Yes, and we also would have Dan Edge from Oregon State University, Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, to co-present with me the Fish Hatchery Research Center.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Before we break, sir, has the Thursday issue been resolved?
Yes. You weren't here, I guess, when I announced that we will meet Thursday.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you all. With that, we'll close the public hearing and adjourn the committee.